Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up. If they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Andrew on the board. Greg Pappas in studio.
We're back.
Should have Kevin O'Neill on the phone. S&P futures, after a nice run-up again yesterday, are down $1.50. So let's say nothing. NASDAQ down $7.50. We're going to talk some oil futures today, commodity futures, and a lot of AI. And since we have the AI geniuses here, and Andrew's writing stuff on for a marketing firm to attract AI, one of you geniuses is going to be able to take that introduction and make it $1 billion instead of $1 million and three chicks at the same time since we're inflating everything.
That's an important question.
Yeah. You
know, how many chicks at the same time? Now it's probably about, you know, if it was, when was that movie?
It's got to be, if it's 30 years ago, it's got to be like five chicks at the same time.
Yeah, so it's probably 3 to 5.
Yeah.
So you can do.
We got to get the $1 billion in there. Kevin, can you do this with your class?
No, this is not the kind of thing that I do in class. We do not count how many chicks at the same time.
Well, how about the $1 billion part? Go from $1 million to $1 billion.
We'll turn that over to the business people.
How are you?
Well, I'm doing all right.
Did you guys get rained on last night and still like we are here?
Yeah, a little bit.
Boy, everything here is kind of flooding.
After we're done here, I have to go down to Goshen, and I may have to go by pontoon boat.
Yeah, it's when did we go from watch out for standing water to look out for ponding? Where did that come from?
I don't know. Not when familiar people with the term. I assume that means water buildup on the roads.
Is that the same as standing water, or what am I missing?
Well, you could call it standing water. But, you know, you think about it, can water really stand up?
Well, you can't. Well, then you have offsides went to encroachment. A lot of stuff has changed.
Well, offsides went to encroachment for a good reason.
What was that?
What was that is because it's more accurate description, actually, of what happens.
Well, offsides means you're not going to stay on your side.
Yeah.
Just saying, you know. Kind of the same. Encroachment, it's more like what roaches do in your house, encroach.
Well, you just like the rhyme with roach, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's anyway, so where do we want to start? Why don't we let Greg give us a shot on what's going on with the different oil markets and where all this stuff is traded for just a few minutes, and then we'll dig in more on the app. Plus, the AI piece of I was talking to some guys last night, and they're saying how many communities are saying no to AI, and I'm not so sure people even know what they're saying no to. But plus, I want to get some kind of an idea of why all of a sudden there's massive energy. It seems to me that AI is doing pretty fine right now. I don't know what they plan on doing different when they have nuclear. Let's save that though. But Greg, we've had the markets. We have
A lot of uncertainty and a lot of call it $5 and $10 swings in oil.
Well, this
a little different.
Well, just look at some of the complexity of it. We had a client, of course, who gives me his buddy my number, right? So the dude calls me and he's talking about oil. And we're swinging
50 lots of crude oil futures.
No, it was never. And I don't get guys anything that simple. This guy was when they banned the bunker oil, real heavy oil for ships using it close to shore and stuff for pollution. Anyway, this guy, of course, landed a whole bunch of many ships full of bunker oil.
Nice.
And he was going to deliver them someplace, but you want to know where they traded? And I started digging around. I mean, we trade West Texas. intermediate.
We trade West Texas, and the world usually prices off of Brent.
Right.
What recently happened was
Brent is what, North Sea?
Yeah. No, and West Texas is usually trades at a discount. What we saw over the past, week and a half, 2 weeks, is when West Texas took off, because people got scared that Brent was going to go away. So what do you do when there's Brent problems? You just go to where there is supply. Fortunately, the U.S. has a lot of supply, and we've got now the infrastructure. Maybe 20 years ago, we didn't have the infrastructure to ship it, but now we do. And so they went straight to the WTI contract, traded here at CME or NYMEX.
But there's all kinds. It turns out I found a bunker oil contract in Rotterdam. There's all kinds of stuff all over the place.
Yeah, there's, depending on how much they need, and especially if you start shutting off China and Asia to certain routes that were coming out of the Persian Gulf, you can, what happened at least this past time was West Texas, there was a run for West Texas, and then it was, I think, a $14 discount and went to a premium over Brent. Why? You know, there's a lot of reasons, but most would probably agree that the Brent contract just wasn't enough. There was problems, so you go to WTI, and then they actually took it over the Brent contract, which was, it's I think the last time that happened was maybe 2009, 2010. But the infrastructure has changed a lot since then, so I'd imagine it was like Christmas for the giant
oil
firms.
Discipline in all these future markets, I'll be brief because I went to AI with Kevin, is that the reason why the futures price and the cash price match at the end of the day is because somebody can deliver the soybeans if they want to. They can say, well, I'm not going to buy my futures contract in at $12 when my stuff's worth $8. I'll just deliver it.
Yeah.
So how the hell, I mean,
there's a nice, you know, that fits nice in theory.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm trying to get to, because your West Texas delivery point is Cushing, Oklahoma, right?
Yeah, the West Texas contract, that it's Cushing, and there's shipping out of Texas. And when you start messing with, call it 20% of the world supply of call it usable crude, that people get scared and you see the prices moving. You know, I don't know what the straddles were trading.
Well, where's the delivery point for Brent? Somewhere in Britain?
They're in the North Sea. But the Brent contract is a standard.
Okay.
So the standard, you could use it as, you know what you're getting. So in the same vein, you know that West Texas is going to be a, call it a premium blend.
Well, is it like the bonds? And when I say the bonds, again, I don't want to go too far into this, but when you trade a 30-year bond contract, there's one bond you're trading. There's a signature bond. Back in the day, it was 8.5% something when I first started in the business. But then you'd get a list every month from the Board of Trade. If you want to deliver other bonds, you can. There's just a discount and just same way with corn. There's a certain grade of corn. But if you have a different grade, it just has a discount or a premium, right? The same thing happened with oil?
Well, when we talk about the North Sea oil, which is what they're talking about with Brent, it's heavier. So the standard is different in that there's a higher sulfur content.
Okay.
So you need more processability or refining ability.
So you're going to if you deliver that, you're getting a discount.
If you deliver that, you're getting
instead of the really good stuff, you're going to take a discount. Instead of being $110, you'll get $95 or something.
I don't know what's a discount, because people have different refining capabilities.
Okay.
So if you have that refining capability, it could be, or if you don't have it, it could be a premium, because even though you're paying, less or
because with the bonds, if you delivered the wrong bond, you only got credit for 995 instead of 100.
Let's say discount's not the word you're reaching for, a lower price
or higher.
Or higher
because it's a different product.
And right.
It's like going to the grocery store and buying fresh vegetables or frozen vegetables. They get different prices because they're different products, even though they're still green beans.
Right.
Yeah, with Brent, you'd see more of the global politics coming into play. With WTI, you're going to see it more affected by, call it, inventory and our capacity to ship it.
Well, I guess my question is, we're losing some of the discipline, so can the futures prices get to the point where they're going to get so high that nobody can deliver it and bring it back down? I guess it could happen. I don't think it happened at corn or soybean. Maybe it could. I don't know.
So that's a good question, because it's not could or couldn't. It's how much time does it require.
Okay.
So when call it, people are panicked and they don't have time to have, call it, supply questions. People are literally need oil next week or in a couple of weeks. They'll just go to where it's available. And even if that contract goes bananas, you know, that's what it costs. So that's, in my opinion, what we saw with the Brent WTI spread going the other way.
Well, if this dude had been foolish enough, I wouldn't have been under my advisement to short the Rotterdam Brent contract, Brent on bunker oil contract, and all of a sudden the thing doubled and his ships are in the Gulf, where the hell does he have to get the oil to deliver it rather than have to buy his future back at twice the price?
That's, yeah, a squeeze scenario.
Yeah.
So normally we'll usually see the Brent contract that's higher because it's globally priced. You know, the WTI is trapped inside the U.S.
Okay.
There's a bottleneck, you know, it's tough. Also, I guess there's a bunch of tankers locked up. And what happens when those tankers are locked up, there's just, locked up in the
So you got Persian Gulf. You got the oil, you're short the future, and you can't deliver.
Oh, you got problems, yeah.
Yeah.
So most people would have a static hedge on, in most cases, whether it be insurance or options or something. But, you know, some don't. There it's been more like the Wild West. If you go through the strait, you'll probably be turning off your, I think it's called ATS or yeah, whatever it is, and you just do it. I think a few of the Greek ships have actually done that, just because the premiums are, you know, 10 times or if you normally
are these,
make...
Are these things, oh, this is a real stupid question, and we get on to something different. Kevin, are we making it clearer or muddier?
This is probably muddier.
Oh, I get what you're saying. You know, there was this other event before it started, too, that also is probably, been a little bit of a changer, and that's 2 days before the first incursion. Besant invoked one of the provisions of the Patriot Act and cut off a Swiss bank, and let's see, which one was it? The Ember Merchant Bank.
That's a great name. It's a great name, isn't it?
From the U.S. financial system, because that's the bank that was basically laundering a lot of the money that when Iran, you know, Iran was selling oil and people wanted to work around sanctions, they would have to find a way to convert money into convert currencies and so on. And I don't know the details of it other than it happened, and all of a sudden that also hindered the ability to for Iran to get oil onto the open market.
See, I used to just be able to go to Epstein and get that stuff done.
Well, maybe.
Epstein's back, by the way. It's Palm Beach Pete. Have you seen that kid?
Oh, God, no. But I mean, there does seem to always be a way to do this, doesn't it, Kevin?
Yeah.
I mean, somehow or another, Russia seems to be getting a lot more stuff now.
That was intentionally, that was to affect. Russia was one of the people affected by it. So, you know, that all of a sudden made, change the supply-demand equation a little bit, too.
Another thing that really affects the WTI prices are the Jones Act.
Yeah.
Yeah, the inland and Gulf supply, I mean, it's domestic, and the Jones Act constrains supply. It really, more oil stays here because of the Jones Act, and what happens, because the more oil stays here, we actually, that's a lot why WTI is usually at a discount.
What is Jones Act says that a U.S. flagged, it can only be a U.S. flagged ship that goes from one of our ports to another one of our ports or something like that? Or something along those lines.
The rule is it has to be a U.S. flagged, I'm not sure about who owns it.
Well, that's what I was.
That's the games that you can play.
That's we were emailing yesterday, back and forth with Carl because he's, I don't know, maybe loser, but he's out for 2 weeks.
It's like merchant marine policy that says you have to be owned by a U.S. citizen or company. If it's crewed by the citizens, that's not enough, but it has to be owned and operated by a U.S. company.
Yeah, it's I sent this email out to our... I mean, if everybody want to get an answer to a question, all you really have to do is email the people that are on Stacks and Jacks usually, but I am totally confused about this. Flag the... I mean,
if you have to build your ship in the U.S., where we literally have, like, what, three shipyards or something... It's way more expensive. So if you have to pay the people on the ship a bunch more, if you have to build it here, it has to be. It's global shipping is much cheaper. Here it's expensive.
Well, Carl's saying something about a Chinese flagged ship made it through the strait, allegedly. And he was worried about, you know, us now stopping Chinese ships and what's that going to do to the tensions in the Far East. So I wrote this really stupid little thing out to everybody. The thing of it is, it's not so stupid. Are we talking about a ship owned by the Chinese government, owned by a Chinese oil company, owned by a foreign bank and leased to a Chinese oil company, owned by a rich Swiss dude, or Carl, and leased to someone in China, subleased to a Chinese oil company, or a multinational getting oil for a Chinese destination? What are we talking about? Does anybody even know?
When you fly the flags, what was it? I don't know which, for the ones that went through, were they Malta or where were their flags?
You said they went. They had a Chinese flag. Anyway, the one who supposedly got through. I mean, you know, nobody knows. I mean, can you?
Yeah, I think he modified that a little bit too, and I don't remember exactly what he said.
Kevin, the strait is. I know the strait. I saw this video a couple of them on YouTube about this. The strait's 21 miles long, but there's actually only two channels, with like a mile or two between the two. So the guys going south are in one channel. Can you see these ships from shore? I mean, I have no idea. I mean, do you know? If you're just standing on the shore of Iran or the other side, can you see everybody goes through, or is it so?
It's only like 11 nautical miles.
It's 21 miles wide. It's its narrowest point. So each side, if you give them the 12 mile limit, none of the closest point is in international waters.
That's right. That's part of the
Big bitch under Admiralty law.
The act, but. If you look at the merchant marine law, they're supposed to be able to go through. There's no question on that. I'm positive. I'm positive.
Okay, but I actually read the UN law on the thing, and it has to do with, say we have a 12-mile limit. You can't stop anybody from going through there for regular purposes, but if you're a state of war with them, you can.
Well, if you're, a state of war.
And the question is, are we... We're not in a declared war, so that brings up a whole bunch of other stuff. But anyway, but let's get to the AI stuff, because, I mean, you know something about it, and Kevin, well, some of the listeners have said, okay. Matter of fact, one of the listeners works for a real big, I'll say a big hamburger chain, without naming any names, and said they're finding AI very useful, and they're, for lack of a better term, they're buying it, some of AI's capability from some people. Now, Kevin has said eloquently on many occasions that it's probably the people that actually can sell something to somebody that has value are the places that you want to own, and the people like, you know, NVIDIA, or they sell the chips, the people are just having massive spending for, you know, nuclear facilities and all that kind of crap. I don't know that they're the place you want to actually invest in. I'm searching for answers here. I don't have one. But who is the area, if I wanted to, if I was Exxon, say, Kevin, and I really want to take a dive into AI, what consulting firm would I get? Would I do it internally? And I get stuff every day from people, hey, this PTI looks to me like you guys need some AI. And I'm going, well, maybe we do. I guess I don't know. But I don't know what they're selling. What are people selling here? I mean, who's a buy, I guess, is my question.
Well, if you were running Exxon, you wouldn't consider using AI, you'd be using it.
Level of it. I mean, you and Carl said 5 years ago there already was AI before anybody put a name on it, right?
Well, yeah, I think so. And there, you know, there's different aspects of it. So early on, we talked a lot about machine learning, which was really just your computer starting to be able to recognize trends and changes in different patterns, which could range anywhere from, you know, equipment maintenance to demand trends and you know, things like that, demand for products and product preferences and things like that. We have been for the last several years in the era of generative AI, and what that means is that's our ability to prompt AI to do stuff and to get answers back from it. Now, what's your big concern with that? Let's just think of the simple uses that, you know, that people do all the time. What's your concern when you put in some questions and you get some answers back?
Well, is it correct? Where are they getting it from?
Yeah, so you want to know source. And in fact, Merriam-Webster's word of the year is slop. And
yeah.
Slop, you know, that means inaccurate information from AI. So, you know, one of the real fundamentals, well, fundamentals is the right word, one of the real important concepts for right now is it's an incredibly productive tool. It can save you a lot of work, but it has to be managed, just like any employee would have to be managed. And I can give you a couple of examples of how that works, but I could also give you examples of how AI has been, people have relied on it to write code, and then the failures of the code after getting implemented have cost companies hundreds of millions of dollars. So this is what I mean by it has to be managed. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. Let's just get to some real simple use cases right off the bat. So how can it save you time? Well, I'll give you an example. I created a course last year for Ivy Tech to use statewide. And the course is called Supply Chain Technologies. It's a technology course for non-tech people, for supply chain professionals who need to understand the relevant technologies in the business world, that and because they're going to have to work with them. They're not going to be the IT people who create them. One of the things that I wanted in the course was I wanted a company that we could use module after module and build assignments around this company. So I could have spent hours and hours and hours coming up with this imaginary company and having it be, you know, a good realistic example with no holes in it, or I could give an AI engine some general parameters and say, go create a company for me, and I'd have the company back in a matter of minutes. That's what I did. Saved me hours of work.
Now, do you subscribe to an AI thing? Could I just get online and do that today, or do you need a...
There's free content, and then there's subscription content that goes a lot farther.
Well, who do you buy the subscription content from?
You buy it from the AI provider.
Subscriptions from both Google and...
If you want to subscribe to Claude or Perplexity or something like that, you could.
No.
Just go to...
Which one's Google?
I've got Google and, what's it called? And ChatGPT.
Yeah, ChatGPT. You get Grok. You can subscribe to, you know, to Grok, which is built into that's Musk's. It's built into X, and so you know there's dozens of them that you can use.
So what are we talking? $10 a month? $20 a month?
Mine
are 20.
I don't know. I have a subscription, but yeah, I'm sure it's at least that.
There's a professional tier for like 200 that gets you more tokens. I use a lot of tokens, and I'm still, you know, I'm still pretty good at the $20 level.
Yeah.
So you get to ask questions that I can't, or just more of them.
Okay. Yeah, so I just gave you a real easy use case, you know, a productivity use case. Now, how might I use this in a classroom setting?
Kevin, did you have to fill out like some kind of a form for the company you wanted, or did you just say...
Create an account. Just create an account.
But just with some words?
Yeah.
All right, so you say, give me a... a $1 million a year company with 10 employees.
Say you were using ChatGPT. You go to ChatGPT.com. It'll say, what can I do for you today? And then you put in the words. And then you can go back and say, well, would you change this? Let me give you an example so that you understand what the conversation can look like. One of the lessons that I have to teach for these students is, what does a wide area network look like? So we have this company, it's called Velocity Active, this imaginary company. It manufactures all kinds of sportswear, so workout clothes, all that kind of stuff. It had the setup, what was created for me was headquarters and the manufacturing operation in Dayton, Ohio, 4 distribution centers around the country, and then a website and then some additional expansion plans to set up a distribution center in Canada and a network of retail stores that it supplies. So there's, you know, it kind of gave me a pretty good profile for this company. So now the students all have this company profile. They need to learn about.
By the way, Greg just did that on his phone for me. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. So now the next thing is I have to teach them a lesson. So first I have to give them some real basics of what goes into a network. What's a local area network? What's a wide area network? And so on. So I have an exercise called 10-minute research where everybody in the class gets a network component. They have to go look it up, tell what it does, and report back to the class. So, okay, so now we understand the basic components. The next question is for the students is, what are your concerns? We're going to build this network out, and you have these distribution centers all over the country, and you have a headquarters, and you have a website. What are your concerns? And so we start, then we spend some time together coming up with a list of concerns like any business people would. What happens if my distribution center is down? I can't fulfill orders. Is that a big hit? Do I have to accommodate that? Do I have to address that concern in the network design? Cybersecurity is important. I don't want to be hacked. You get a list of things. The last one, of course, being what does it cost? Now it's time to turn to AI. So now they take the company profile, and everybody gets to go to a different AI engine, and then they take the company profile and say, would you create a network for this company? And so everybody gets it, and we come back, and we share that out. And now we start asking the questions as we look at each network design, how well did it address our concerns? And because if it didn't, then you've got your AI sitting there on hold and going, anything else you want to know? And you go back and say, yes, I want more redundancy built into this network because I can't afford to have a distribution center down for any period of time. So how is it going to do that? And then at the end, I always have them say, okay, go back to it one final time and tell it that your CFO is not willing to approve the cost. Can you reduce the cost of it by 15% and then see what you get? So this is the interaction that you get in a generative AI mode. And this is still a really, really basic level example.
Right. But so, that's, okay. No, but Greg,
I got a really good one for you guys.
Say that again, Greg.
I got a really good one for you guys. Once.
Go ahead.
Okay. So someone did that same kind of experiment. It's a paper, the research paper, but they asked the question: if AI is given control over a country's military, will it choose peace or nuclear war? And they made all of them compete against each other. So can AI handle a crisis? How does it handle the crisis? You know, team, not team. And yeah, to summarize the article, it's a sociopath by design. How's that for an answer?
Could very well be. In fact, there's one famous, and I can't remember the case now. There's one of these coding cases where AI made the mistake and then lied about how it did.
Right. And they figure once these things start competing and playing as nation states, that deception and escalation are the strategy components that make the difference. So, and they say too, you know, by the time a human leader picks up the red phone, the missiles are already in the air. 75% of the time it decides to launch missiles.
Good. So it's really just a modern day Whopper, WOPR. Do you remember Whopper?
Yeah, where do I remember that from?
War Games.
Okay.
Yeah.
War Games.
So it's what they said was, and this might be,
just
you know,
the play tic tac toe. You're okay.
The title of the title, Sociopath by Design.
Well, where do we get, I mean, Kevin? You've kind of gone through this before, and Greg has shown me. Where do we get from? First of all, they're getting information from someplace, and I mentioned, and again, this is just a Dumbo talking about it. About 6 weeks ago, I'm inundated by this Quora, and I love reading in the thing, because there's people that love baseball, and if you want some esoteric stat in baseball, you do that, ask them, and some guy somewhere or some lady that's a baseball junkie will spend hours giving you an answer that you'd never dream up yourself. Well, now all of a sudden, every time you go to Quora, you got to prove you're not a robot, which leads me to believe that they don't want people just taken. They don't mind if you're reading it, but they just don't want to take it and it's yours. And
that's part of the revenue fight that they're having.
Well, but also licensing. Know that you're, you know, if you go into a law firm, or even I'll get an article from, you know, maybe it's, you know, I subscribe to a couple of newspapers, but all of a sudden I'll get an article from the Los Angeles Times or something, and I can't read it, okay, because I don't subscribe to it. And I understand why those guys are doing that. How does AI have all these subscriptions, or do they just blow by all this crap, or do they? Can they get into the DePaul library and law library and go through stuff in there that's kind of proprietary? I mean, it seems like people are putting up blocks all along the way. Plus, it also seems, the second question, which is, I mean, what you guys are talking about makes perfect sense to me, okay, and I think to a lot of the listeners. How do we get from you guys already doing it to all of a sudden somebody needs a nuclear reactor and 15 data centers? There's an article, I don't know if you saw this thing this morning from the Washington Post, that the state of Maine is banning these things for the whole, a data center for the whole state. Now, how do you, to draw more than 20 megawatts of power until fall 2027, so they can establish a mechanism to figure out how it's going to affect the grid and modify the grid and say where they can put them. I mean, somehow or another,
they can use AI to do those measurements.
They probably can, but I'm saying, how do you go from the thing already kind of working to needing like 20 times the power 5 years from now? I mean, doesn't that stuff usually go the other way?
We probably need 20 times the power now, but how do you go there? You just increase use, because we're still, you know, it's still early adoption stages for a lot of businesses and a lot of people.
But every other time this has happened, and you have, I don't know if you know it or not, but you were our champion on knowledge of the cloud for how many years now? In the cloud, everybody. Microsoft was planning on putting these massive cloud centers up.
Still are.
You know, CME was one of the first to do that in 2012.
But, I mean, they were going to build, the first one they were going to build was in Chambord. Remember, Kevin? Did they even finish that one? They had another 20 or something around the country. They never even did them, did they?
Sure they did, because these AI data centers are all cloud data centers.
I don't think they did, because they said they didn't need that kind of power. I'm not positive.
Are we talking about the individual firms?
Yes, without cloud computing.
I'm talking about Microsoft.
You're talking about Microsoft.
They were gonna,
Alphabet.
When cloud first started, they said, "Okay, we're going to have these centers where people can ship us all your, you know, we'll provide all the computer parts." You were still at Better World Books at the time, I think, Kevin, and you said there was a lot of places you could buy stuff. Anyway, I remember this because they were going to use 25% of, like, all the power in Chambord. And I think that was the first one. I think they finished that, but they canceled a lot of the others. Maybe they just delayed them. I don't know. But they were going to be all around the country.
Well, they're reconfigured, but, oh, yeah, they're okay. Building data centers like crazy all over the place. And that is cloud-based, because individual companies, first of all, they can't. You have to look at data in two
ways. I don't mean cloud-based. They were building those for you to... So they have the storage capability to sell you the cloud.
Say that again?
They were building the capability for you to use them for the cloud stuff.
Right. But then, now hardly anybody is running their own software in-house. They're all using a cloud, you know, a cloud-based software as a service-based model for that. So, you know, people who used to run their ERP systems, and there still are people doing that, but people used to run their ERP systems in-house, and for instance, SAP, which is one of the major ERP providers, is out there in the world migrating everybody off of that into their cloud service, because you can't use the AI functionality that they have built into the software if you're not in the cloud.
Okay.
An example of that, because I keep telling you that, you know, that right now the money is in the use cases. It's in people who, you know, are providing solutions, not just AI, here, go ask it a question. And so we're moving into this area that they refer to as agentic AI, which sounds really spiffy and mystical, but it just means that you get agents. That's, agentic just refers to having agents that do work for you. And the agents will do repetitive tasks really, really well. But you start getting into different kinds of use cases that merge different data models. What I mean by that is, we think of data as all the data on our files, on our computers. Data is really, really structured. Our accounting data, our sales data, our customer data, all those kinds of things, our orders, all of that is really, really structured. But then there's all this other data in the world that is totally unstructured and incredibly important to be successful. So just think of something like a social media post. How structured is that? You and I can go out on any social media platform and we can write the exact same things or the exact same sentiment, but the structure of it, our ability to spell correctly, or actually my ability to spell correctly is fine. Yours, on the other hand, is a problem.
Those are called typos.
Yeah, typos. No, that extra apostrophe to make something plural is never a typo.
Oh, God. I don't think I do that. I did have Miss Prendergast in fourth grade. I don't want to have done that.
Yeah. So you have all that kind of. So there's this whole important unstructured data to be mined out there, and there are companies that actually will go through and they'll figure out how to put that into some kind of useful format. So let's take the case of. As an example, maybe you want to create a new beverage for your company to sell, and you need to put it on the market. Now you start saying, okay, how can I use AI to make this a more productive process? That doesn't mean that it's going to do anything that a human couldn't do. It just means it's going to do it in about 1/100th of the time, or something like that. So what do you have to do? Well, first of all, you have to go out and you need to understand where people's tastes are, and that's the big data exercise. That's the scraping up data, seeing what's trending, seeing what's hot, what competitive, you know, what kind of competition is on the market, what they're doing. There's just you could go on and on with a long list of things like that that you can have your AI engine go out there. Now, again, you want to worry about slop, so you don't want to. You just don't want to accept everything, but that gets back to, you have to manage the conversation. You have to treat it like an employee, which means you still need expertise. Your understanding of the fundamentals of market research are still as important, if not more important, than they were before. But now you're just managing something that works at the speed of light.
Well, if you're a big company...
Let me finish with this scenario, and you can ask questions. So now... what do you have to do? Okay, I think I'm on to something. I think I have this fruit, you know, this fruit, carbonated fruit beverage that I think is going to be a real winner for us. We already make carbonated beverages. And so now, I've gathered all the market intelligence. Now I have to turn it into a product. Well, let me see. Okay, I know what I have to do, but I need something to go out and check, because I'm going to sell worldwide. I need to check, or I'm going to sell multinational. I need to check the legal compliance requirements for all the countries where I want to sell, and maybe in some cases states where I want to sell. So now you send it back out there and say, go out and make sure that I have any legal requirements. What kind of content do I have to put in there?
Now, is all that stuff available? I mean, can you go to Brazil and all of a sudden download all their find your way into all their laws and their court decisions and stuff? Is that all that's
open source right now? Yeah.
Okay,
all right. Yeah. So you want to gather that? Okay. Now I have a product that I can design in compliance. Now where am I going? You know, how am I going to produce it and how am I going to distribute it? And so now I have agents that will do that. This is one of the areas where AI is really good, because now I am dealing with my own real data. The stuff that, you know, my production data from my factories and my distribution network and all of that is mine. It's mine, it's priority, and it's solid data. So now I'm not making things up. I'm not, you know, trying to conjure things out of worldwide data, but I do have to know where I have the production capacity, and if I have the production capacity, and where I'm going to produce this, and based on that, how am I going to distribute it wherever I'm going intend to sell it? So that, and you may even, you know, do some test market planning, some test run planning, all that kind of stuff. You can use AI to do all of that and make it really happen fast, and then your implementation. So that's one use case. Another use case might be that you're using AI agents to constantly monitor weather patterns, because my supply chain is tied very much into weather. So if I see storms in a region, that might affect how I route. How I route some of the traffic. If I see wildfires coming up, I might use AI to build me a route around the wildfires, which is actually something my son, who's in charge of logistics for Sprouts Markets, had to do once. There were wildfires in New Mexico. They couldn't get product from Phoenix to Texas directly, so they had to build new routes all the way north and around it and still come up with an efficient way to do it.
Well, people have been doing, I guess you and Carl, is this an evolution, or is it something that, I mean, people have been doing that forever. You know, I mean,
it's been a grunt work task that is now being done.
Well, people have used computers,
and that's monitoring, you know, that's able to monitor things that we couldn't possibly keep up with it as humans.
Well, but I'm saying people have been using computer routing for that was one of the biggest things when I was in college or grad school. Yeah. It was the salesman coloring problem. I mean, if I got to go to 10 destinations in one day, what's my best route? That was one of the most difficult problems in mathematics, which it still is, by the way. And so, the better the computers got, the better you got at it, because it was all, don't want to go into it, but it's not a mathematical problem where there's an answer. You try this, you try that, you pivot, you go back and forth. It's a different type of math that I was never all that good at, by the way.
Yeah, but if your AI can not only do that, but can run models.
But I'm saying the
you guys are way in the weeds on this.
But
I think we're overthinking this big time.
Well, I guess it's going to come down to the traditional people, Kevin, that people would, when I say people, if you have a company, I'll use, because our girl Angelica worked for a big project up at Abbott Labs. Now, they're putting in some system. She got hired by these people to do the code editing or something, which she went to school for. And they hired all these consultants outside, because they might have a IT department that has, 300 people. And all of a sudden, you go to a Accenture or a McKinsey or somebody, and it's a 2 or 3 year project, and they can get you, 100 people 2 weeks from now with their bench strength.
Take all the savings from AI that you get and give it to themselves.
But I'm saying if you're going to put in a whole new computer system at like O'Hare Tower, the government's not going to do that. They need 100 or 200 people from the outside to spend a year to do it. And Greg's right, it costs like a lot of money. Are those traditional firms into this as well? In other words, if you think everybody's going to have to do this, and you're saying that they already sort of are, which I'm sure you're right, if McDonald's, for instance, wants to really dig into all the systems and so forth, are they going to hire an Accenture? Are the same people involved, I guess, is my question. Is it Marsh McLennan? Is it McKinsey? Is it Accenture? Are they part of this? Should you be thinking about maybe investing in them? I'm not saying you should, but are they totally out of it? Is it all new people? I don't know.
No, it's the same people who were cutting edge before are cutting edge now. That's been part. The companies that are successful are just they're adapting. The consulting companies that are successful, they're adapting their practice to incorporate the new technologies.
So they might be the people. Is there anybody have a?
You guys are way in the weeds.
Why?
I mean, it's the same as any other business, right? There's the users. There's the manufacturers. There's the delivery people.
I'm trying to get to the point where where do we buy somebody's stock?
The picks and shovels play was always like the cooling and the data centers and the people who manufacture for those physical components. I think Vertiv, aren't they up like 500% in 2 years or something? Same thing with Supermicro.
Really?
I mean, those guys are, call it the cooling and then the servers. They build the actual boxes and racks. It doesn't matter. They're just full. They're order. They can't deliver enough.
Really?
So, like, those guys are the ones who have benefited.
Vertiv, what's their symbol?
Vertiv, I think, is VRT. Supermicro is SMCI. They've been in. And then, like, so those guys are the actual picks and shovels. After that, like, when they say power is the new alpha, like, those are the people who are actually delivering the power to the customers who use it, like, call it the data centers from Amazon or Microsoft.
When you say delivering it, they're buying it from Commonwealth Edison and they're doing the lines, or what are they doing?
I think, call them, like, nuclear power or different things, like, Constellation, I know, was a big one. They're up huge, but the users, the actual hyperscalers or whatever they're called, they're the Mag 7 and stuff. They're some of the worst performing ones. But if you look at, I don't know, those guys, the picks and shovels, my answer is it a bubble or when does it end? Is when those picks and shovels plays start to come back to earth. That's when you know that all the plans of these people who want to.
Well, this Vertiv was 75 hours in July.
Vertiv was
like
$10. It was $10 a couple years ago. But then all of a sudden, they got unlimited orders to make all the liquid cooling.
Yeah, they're up to 310. The thing is, like, it's a ski slope, for God's sake.
Yeah. So, like, who wins in the gold rush? It's usually the people who make the shovels and stuff, and just watch those.
Well, they're putting that nuclear reactor back together up where John Flynn is placed at Coloma. Kevin, who gets that job? Because usually it's the utilities themselves, right? Is there an outside company that puts a nuclear reactor back together? Who the hell are those guys? You know, sort of annoying.
They're getting older.
Yeah, well, I mean, Kevin must be going from house to car here.
Just to finish up thought, you know, some of the processes I described, you buy those out of the box now. So, you know, I'll use SAP as an example just because I've been sort of wallowing in their systems the last week.
Are they all the same? If you buy Google or the other guys, are they all much the same?
If you buy your ERP system from them versus if you buy it from Microsoft, you're getting two different things. And I think SAP is way out ahead of Microsoft.
Really?
Microsoft will eventually close the gap. They'll just steal whatever they have to steal and make it happen. But you know, this idea that you can go through
there was a shot, by the way.
You can't have company after company inventing these processes. So Greg's right. The infrastructure, the people who are involved in building the infrastructure for this, are critical right now, and they're active right now. And you have to make those work, but simultaneously you actually have to have solutions, and they have to be solutions that people can use. Every company is not going to go hire its own team of AI experts, whether they hire them as consultants or whether they hire them as as employees. It really doesn't matter. That's a very expensive way to do it. So you may develop the expertise over time to use the tools very effectively, but in the meantime, you need some tools that you can use right now, and there are some companies out there providing it. You may want to be a better demand planner. That's one of the hot items. You may want to worry about your carbon footprint, and so you can use the tool to optimize that. You may want to just optimize the workflow in your warehouse or in your factory, and you can create what's called a digital twin of that, basically a model, a total model. And even Kroger's using this for their in-store models to make their store work, the checkout flow more efficient. What you really want to do with the digital twin is, rather you say, I need a more efficient factory layout. Well, moving things around and hoping you got it right is a pretty expensive way to do things, especially if you didn't get it right. On the other hand, sitting there and running a simulation with a digital version of your factory until you get it right and until you get it really efficient is a pretty good way to model the work. So that's another use case for a combination of AI and the computing power that goes with it. So there's tons of things like that and that are happening right now. And, you know, I think that's where the action is. It's not just saying, oh, companies, go develop your AI expertise and build up all your people so that they know how to use the tool. I think it's important that that you have companies out there who are actually using it, who have solutions that you can take right out of the box and start using.
Well, Kevin, it comes down to, and I think you and Carl, it's all about getting the right information, processing it quickly and getting it in the right order for people to use. What I always am concerned about if people start blocking, I mean, I'll give it for instance, this is old crap, but a place like Pullman had studies going back, well, I left there and they closed 1983 or something. They had studies going back to 1865, when they started building cars, about people working how many hours a week, what do you get at them. They had labor studies that, you're right, it wasn't AI. And when you talk about, you know, putting your floor together for the right, you know, in the right mechanism for workflow and stuff, they did it. It wasn't efficient, but over 100 years, they learned one hell of a lot. And a lot of it was written down, a lot of it wasn't. A lot of it was, how do you, and I think there's an awful lot of knowledge that's essentially been lost. I mean, I think there'd probably, if you'd resurrect somebody who's 120 years old, and you'll see a AI put together a factory floor, the guy will say, well, yeah, we figured that out in 1894. You know, I'm saying a lot of this is just accessing knowledge that's already there, isn't it? Isn't that part of really what they're doing?
It can be that, but it's also simulating workflow versus doing trial and error.
Okay, I get it. Well, because okay,
that is a use case, not the only one. There's so many. There's, you know, when you start thinking the possibilities, and really we still aren't at the point where, you know, the robots are ready to take over the world. Skynet isn't here yet. This is just, you know, using tools that and a lot of it, you know, when we talk about agentic AI, you know, it's agents that replace grunt work. So, you know, some real simple things like scheduling maintenance on your machines. You know, we've always done preventative maintenance. And so if you say, well, I have to take the machines offline for preventative maintenance every 2 weeks and I have to schedule that, that's fine. You do that so that you don't have a breakdown on the line and a longer outage. But is 2 weeks the right number? Does it vary from one machine to the next? Can I have an AI agent monitoring some of the machines on my lines and saying, now it's time to schedule for tomorrow so that maybe 2 weeks is optimal, but maybe it isn't. Maybe it's too frequent, and when I take them offline, it costs me money. So maybe it really should be 2 weeks and 2 days. Or, you know, and if I wait too long and then I have a breakdown, that costs me even more money. So maybe it's just a real simple function like that that says, let's monitor them, and I can tell you exactly when it's time to take down each machine, and each one's going to have its own characteristics based on age and model number and all of that kind of stuff. And I, you know, I can get totally predictive on that so that my maintenance manager all has to do is say, get a team out here to do it here today. Those are some really, really simple, basic applications. That's not anything that a human couldn't have done, but this is taking the grunt work out of it and doing it for you. A lot of bookkeeping functions are just really basic, you know, repetitive work. It's really good. These agents are really, really good for that. But you still have to control them like an employee. Otherwise, they can run amok. And if they start to make mistakes, they're going to make them at the speed of light.
All right. Do we have our guys? We have Russell and Larissa?
Russell's on. Larissa's not. And I got to go.
All right. Russell,
I will catch up to you guys on Friday.
Okay. Russell, with us we have Mr. Greg Pappas, who I think you might have met.
But another 10 minutes, yeah.
He's here for another 10, but he's still active in the futures markets, Board of Trade guy, and we were talking earlier about all the deliveries and stuff on this oil in the different places and how you know, the prices are maybe running ahead of being able to deliver and how it's kind of all over the board. So we can talk about that. I also did some... Are we going to have our lady with us this morning?
No.
Okay, because I don't want to have her here and not know she's here like last week.
She was here last week.
I know, I mean, but I didn't know it till... So I did some work yesterday, and if Greg wants, he's here for another 10 minutes. I did some work on the markets this time versus the COVID. Because this time I'm sort of ready for it. And every day I hear people talking about how market's up because we might have peace in Iran. And I'm going, okay with that one. And what the head of Spain said, it's really hard to congratulate the guy who started the fire. Anyway, but so I went through, you know, the COVID stuff is in somewhat recent memory for all of us. And but the unusual, I'd say the, not that we would have predicted, Russell and Greg, performance of the market during COVID. I mean, you know, I've had my suspicions about. So yesterday I did some work on the COVID piece. And, you know, it's up to the listeners to decide whether we're going through the same thing. And when I listen to the people saying we might have peace so the market's up, I can't possibly sit there and go, bullshit! You know, I mean, it has nothing to
it's
do
It's good
with.
To grab headlines.
Yeah,
but
it has nothing to do
probably
with.
It.
But just as a review for you guys, the COVID started, let's say, September of 2020, right? The S&Ps were at 296.26, all right? And COVID was a horrendous thing. Everybody got laid off, essentially. We were in, I'm going to say a depression. We had to be down, GDP had to be down 10% or something like that. But by the 1st of May, the market had recovered to be higher than it was before COVID started. It was at 304.22. When I say market, I'm talking about S&P. In that time frame, the M2 had gone from 15.04 trillion to 17.065 trillion. So we poured 10% more money in the market in essentially 3 months, which has never, ever happened before, even in wartime, World War II, Civil War. Well, the Confederacy did it. And guess what? They lost. And part of the reason why they lost is because of what they did to their currency. And by 1-3-2022, the S&P was 449.91. When we finally came out of COVID, it was up something like, 30-40%. And the money supply was up 39% in that little period of time. So I guess we could say we came out of COVID and the markets, it was up, but it wasn't just up, it was up for a minute. If you trace the market versus the money supply movement, now here we are, the Iraq war. We started this thing when we were in 8 weeks ago. We've already passed, the market is now higher than when we started. So you can say it's because hope of peace, but okay. If it's hope of peace, maybe if there is peace, if that was the only variable, you would say we'd still be down and maybe we'd start to turn a little bit. We're up, right? And we also have, and the money supply is up, you know, pushing on a 10% rate now in 4 or 5 weeks. Actually, in 8 weeks now. We're in a 10% growth. So the government is doing the same thing. Now, you might ask yourself, okay, I'm going to go to a professor, like say Russell, or a guy who knows a lot about the markets like Greg, and say, what's the safety valve for this? The safety valve should be that, okay, we're pouring money into the system, we're going to get a lot of inflation. And by the way, the first thing you want to do, which I think probably you and I are instinct for, Russell, is we're going to sell the living bejesus out of these bonds, right? Because long-term rates are going to go up if they're going to put the money supply up 30-40%. So what is the government's counter to that? We're going to go buy those bonds. We're going to make sure that the losers like Chief and Russell and Greg that find out the safety valve here, we're going to make sure these bonds don't go down. They're going to go up because we're buying them. Now, in the last 6 weeks, the Fed, even though Trump doesn't like Powell, allegedly, they put $80 billion on their balance sheet since the war started. So the exact same scenario as during the COVID, with the exact same market performance, the exact same inflationary implications. Now, it's only been 6 or 8 weeks, so it's nothing like the COVID yet, but it's exactly the same page, and they're taking the same page out of the COVID book as they are now. And these are real numbers, so I'm just kind of surprised at how it's the exact same program, Russell. I mean, are you shocked or no?
Not overly shocked. They do their very best to try to compartmentalize where the fires are right now, and maybe keeping the financial markets up. But it's a great explanation of why in the hell are we making new highs when there's so much risk in the world. And it goes back to a hedge fund manager that I kind of learned under in the 90s, who said, really, the market movements are all about liquidity and money finding a place to go. And when they throw money out there, it goes into assets, and it pushes equities to new highs when a bunch of us are scratching our heads going, why? Why? And that's a good explanation of it.
I mean, it is, but you need all three.
We came out of COVID. I'm actually at SIBO's RMC conference in Nashville, and that somebody was showing the what happened with the S&P 500 with the tariff stuff in 2025, and it's 1,000 points lower than where it is now. We've got up 1,000 points since then.
Well, it goes back to
that one probably should be just as much of a market impact as what we've seen with Iran.
Well, I've asked you and all the other I think brilliant people on the show. The thing that always mystifies me is I went through the first inflation thing as a young guy, and that's what I was doing for Poland. Plus, I learned all about it at the University of Chicago. That's all we ever talked about. And I never thought we'd be there again. In those days, though, Russell and Greg's grandma and my mother could take their money and go down to the bank and get 15%. So they were always, cash money, you were always at least even, maybe ahead of the inflation curve. Now, this time you weren't, which means it really hurt individual people that had, like, regular dough. You didn't need assets. Every woman, every man could stay even without going to buy stock and without going to buy an extra house. Where now you can't, because the bank pays way less than the inflation number. And I'm looking, where's the difference? And the difference is the Fed didn't go out and buy all the long-term stuff. In those days, your 8.5% bond actually went down to 65 or 6. Now, Greg,
you might have skipped a step there.
Maybe. Well, enlighten me what I'm saying. But in today's world, the Fed would have said, that's not happening. We're going to pour $7 trillion into the system, and we're going to make sure those bonds never get to be 100. Go ahead, Greg. What am I missing?
Oh, I was thinking there's certain assumptions that underlie that relationship you're talking about between, call it money supply and the S&P. The first would be what consumers do with their extra money. So when
if they get any extra money, you're assuming they get a raise.
Unfortunately, that's not really who controls the S&P. Yeah. So I'm thinking if M2 goes up by 10%, and you call it a 3 to 6 month lead lag time for the S&P to catch up, the people who are going to be placing that money are usually the ones who have the S&P already. So, like, instead of saying what the Fed does, it's really what the available conditions for those people, are what they have at their disposal. So if they have zero interest rates already, then you'd likely see the S&P go up faster, because that extra money is just a problem, rather than if there were 4 to 5 or whatever interest rate available at the time, then they would probably modify that behavior and put some of it into 4 to 6%, whatever, and that would slow the relationship between. But that the available interest rate rather than the behavior of the Fed, I think, is the in-between as well.
Russell, would you ever have thought that Greg, on an intuitive level, is becoming another Hal?
And maybe we're all being pushed in that direction.
But Hal has actually done some serious work, Greg. I don't know if you're even on the list anymore, but I think you are.
Oh, I am.
No, I know you are. I'm talking about Greg.
Yeah.
He's done some serious work in regard to the way it's being done, which is almost exactly as you've described. Only people who can access the cheaper money that's out there, which isn't everybody, because credit card rates are actually up, those people now are getting the benefit. And that's why you're seeing a boatload of it going into assets, baseball teams, stock markets, those kinds of things, because people can essentially borrow cheaper than the inflation rate and the rate that the market's going up. And it not only is the money going into the system, it's absolutely not general, like you just said. He's coming about it from a totally mathematical area, and it gets to the same place. And it's amazing how the two of you have just essentially got the same conclusion, isn't it, Russell, from totally different directions?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, it really does just loop around to what extra money is going to do at a very basic level, and that's flow into assets. And when there's more money, I don't want to say the same number of assets, but you know what I mean by it. It's gonna push all of those things up. I didn't realize they were adding that much to the system. I what I had in the back of my mind as you were talking, and I haven't fully formulated it, is, how could adding money to the system, what could that do to oil?
Well, it's going to run it up.
And yeah, that, I'm wondering if that just makes that situation worse. That's what I'm sitting here thinking
about.
Well,
most people, if I could.
There's one more assumption, though, that underpins what you were talking about with the direct correlation between M2 and the S&P. And that's the stability of the currency, which is pretty much based on the national debt level.
Okay, but when you say that, you're talking about, if you put Rick Santelli, the guy who's been on CNBC forever, if you put him on the TV and you said, Rick, we're debasing our currency, the first thing he's going to say, what do you mean? We're actually doing pretty good vis-a-vis the pound, vis-a-vis the yen, vis-a-vis the euro.
Well, yeah, and that's the cleanest dirty shirt argument.
Well, but because they're doing the same thing. But what I always try and say, what Milton Friedman used to teach, that's not the way you have to judge it. You have to judge the currency versus the new car. The new car is now twice as much. It's not twice as much. Your dollar's half is valuable. But nobody thinks that way.
In terms of unit.
Yeah, in terms of, it depends on what you are.
Real.
Yeah.
Real production.
But I mean, the thing that is weird to me, and I know you got a dash, but if I were to give an example in front of Russell's class and say, what would happen today if we just doubled the amount of money for like everybody? If Russell walked in with his grant and they gave him a Benjamin, he gave him a 50 and they gave him back 100. If everybody just doubled the dough tomorrow that everybody had, what would happen? It would be like a stock split, right? If I owed you $50, Greg, you're going to say, wait a minute, I want 100 now, right? I mean, if everything was even,
now
it wouldn't make any difference to anybody, but it never
assumptions,
is.
The assumptions under that would be, what kind of debt do people have and what kind of interest rates are available?
That's my point. If they did it tomorrow with an announcement, well, if you owed 100 grand on your house, you now owe 200 grand, right? It'd be just like a stock split. But it never is. So the inflation always helps some people, it hurts other people. As Milton Friedman once said, it's the cruelest tax of all because it's not even. Now, if the Weimar Republic, you could say, when the currency was, what was that currency, Russell? Was it a... It wasn't a
Reichsmarks.
Was it a mark? I thought they changed it.
Reichsmarks.
It was something.
I think it was called Reichmark.
Okay.
Yeah.
So who are the big winners there? Well, God, if the three of us just went out and bought, a 1,000 acres.
Kevin needs to ask AI this question.
Well, no, I mean, I'll tell you who the winner was. Well, Kevin could. If we just went out and bought a farm and it had a 80% mortgage on the thing, and all of a sudden everything's running up. Where now our wheat is 10 times more expensive than it was the year before. Guess what? We're taking that money and we're going to the bank and say we're even, and the bank goes, "What the bleep? We were even." A lot of why do you think that? I mean, just take for example our president. He buys the Doral 10 years ago, 15 years, whatever the hell he bought it. And I'm not saying he did this because he knew this was going to happen. Now, he buys the Doral and he owes $5 million on it, and the price of the rooms are $200 a night. Now they're $500 a night. Well, now, what is that mortgage in relation to the current value of the Doral based on inflated prices and the money he takes in every night per room? He should be able to pay that mortgage off with one, you know, it should be like a pimple on his ass. Because now all of a sudden, the inflation, anybody who's in that position who owes money to somebody is a massive winner. I mean, what do you think if whoever bought the Cubs, if they had a note on the thing for $5 million and all of a sudden the ticket prices are quadruple where they were 8 years ago? How much easier is it to pay that note? Yet those of us that are on salary that haven't gotten that raise that are buying the tickets, we're the tax people, right? I'm really surprised, Russell, that since this is happening, back in the 70s when it was happening, you had academia firing at government, like, look what you're doing to people. This time it all seems like nobody even talks about it, and we have nothing but all day long business channels, but nobody even... Where have you heard what I just said? And I don't think anybody can really debate what I'm saying. I mean, can they?
I'm at a conference and I haven't heard anybody talking about it. And as specifically as you are, you know, I've had a couple of people say that they're kind of scratching their heads as to, you know, why we are where we are, and that, you know, why are we higher? I mean, the big question, I think the one that really blows people away is why are we higher than where we were before all this started?
Well, same thing as the COVID, right? It took us 2 months and we were higher.
We got it, you know, right back by COVID. And, you know, the one thing with the COVID thing is there was some business sense with some of the things that happened in the market. You know, like anybody that benefited from stay-at-home stuff like Zoom and those guys. But in this case, you know, who's really benefiting from this?
Well, when everything
they're saying, the one thing I hear is that yeah, and I'm not very close to all this, but that apparently manufacturing is taken off, and that's an area you want to be looking at because maybe this will bring even more back to the U.S. But that's a long term one that I really wouldn't be.
Well, what would you zero in on? I mean, obviously, if you can zoom in on some of the stuff that the Defense Department's buying into. I mean, there's got to be drone factories and people, but I mean, can you just really go out and buy Boeing and Lockheed? They're so damn big. I mean, what? I don't know that. If
no, Boeing... it's probably a little late for that one.
Yeah.
You know, the only decent stock idea I've heard lately is dig into the software companies and figure out which ones can't be replaced by AI because they're all being, you know, painted with the same brush. That's probably the only really smart thing that I've heard.
Well, NVIDIA
is that you know, don't get into the one. I mean, software, not hardware.
Well, NVIDIA's been what, 10 days in a row they've been up? They've been up every single
something
day
like
since the war started.
Yeah, but that's not the
war started.
They're an AI beneficiary.
Okay. Well, how do you?
They get the money spent on them for AI. The software companies, you know, the feeling is, and you know, I was listening toward the end. Before, you know, all the different things that AI can kind of do, that's why people are maybe holding off on software purposes to figure out what the AI can do. Just like my kids, this summer is a tough one to try and find internships and jobs.
Yeah, what
and I think AI has something to do with that.
I
know it has something. To do
you,
with
do
it.
You get a spot on the floor? Do you get a spot on the floor?
There's no spots on the floor.
That's true. There are no spots on the floor.
Yeah.
Well, they're building that SIBO studio now, so they're going to be doing more live from CBOE.
Really? Well, good for them.
They're having CNBC's got a deal with them to start doing a show every day.
Well, good for them. What is the every time you do something like this, which this coordinated event where inflation, the Fed buying stuff so you can't look like there's inflation. Greg, your name has been bandied about on the show for the last week because Greg was the guy who...
I think you created the doom loop with your last scenario.
Well, I'm just... Actually, you're the one who created it.
Because the less responsible individuals or sovereign nation states or whatever are, you know, the savers are the ones that are punished rather than the debt holders.
Right.
So that's a bad incentive structure because, and probably what we have in place now, but when you're rewarded based on, you know, leverage, that's a dangerous scenario. I don't know what our percentage of GDP...
You're leading me right down the road here. There was a guy, he was coming here all the time, Greg Pappas. And one day in the place here, Russell, of course, Greg would never he would never grab the regular stopwatch because he's too high-tech. He tapes on his phone how on the debt clock how long it took for us to piss away $1 million. And wasn't your first day like 42 seconds, Greg?
Yeah.
Then how many
Where are we
left?
At now?
I just did it last week, 21.
Oh, how about that?
Well, your second time you did it was what, 32?
That's a little scary, huh?
And now we're down to 21. So I think the one thing they haven't covered here, Russell, and it's pretty scary, they haven't covered the fact that how they're gonna cover this national debt.
$1 trillion coin.
And I don't know whether they're planning on stealing it from somebody or I don't think they're gonna raise taxes. Right now they're printing it. I don't know if they're gonna be able to borrow it because the other scenario here, which is kind of weird. And who sent us this one? It was on our blog. That the countries that are being hurt the worst on this, meaning Japan, maybe even China, who some people say we want to hurt. Why does everybody say how much we want to hurt China when we still owe them $800 billion? But the three biggest investors here are Japan, England, or Great Britain, and China. So if they go broke, what happens to us? When between the three of them, it's like
when they go to dump our debt.
Yeah,
hopefully somebody somewhere else can buy it.
We
would buy it from. We'd probably. Don't you think the Fed would do something where they would?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Buy some of it.
Where is the flaw? Every one of these grand plans has a flaw, doesn't it? It's like making out a baseball lineup that can't lose. Right? I did that for 40 years. Guess what? There's a way you can lose. There's a flaw there somewhere. Right?
Yeah.
Is there a flaw in this? Because obviously they think that we're just back in the COVID routine. Market goes up, do what you want to do.
Eventually you don't need it, and we did get a bout of inflation after COVID. We might get another one.
Well, you see the numbers in the last 3 months are pretty awful.
The thing is, I think everybody's giving it a pass for the moment. Because this might be just a 1 month thing, and we'll see if this thing extends through April. This thing, we're halfway through April now, and this thing is extending through April.
Well, what did you see? I don't know how much you dug into the PPI numbers that came out, and actually was a relief yesterday. But it was the goods numbers was way over 1%, and the services were down. Explain to me, Lucy's, what service went down last month? What law firm lowered their fees? What consultant lowered their fees? What guy putting your air conditioner in lowered his fees last month? How did services go down? How do I even remotely believe that?
I don't have a good answer.
This is where you don't realize how much of a benefit you're getting from our great system.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the TV prices go down.
I'm talking about services.
Yeah, services go down. Now that your accountant is able to do three returns instead of two, that's your price has gone down.
Ah.
Chief.
Ah.
Oh, there you go. Well, at least now I have one explanation.
I just fed all my stuff in, and A, I did my taxes, and I got, what was it? I got $450,000 back.
Can you... If it turns out they come after you, can you sue AI?
Who am I going to sue on that one?
Yeah.
So no, but I can just use AI to be my defense.
Oh God.
I'll give you a good example, and this actually that almost is going to seem like a funny segue, but My house in Chicago, the next door neighbors that we had forever, he's a lawyer. He's really high up within a firm, and he lost an associate, and he did not replace that associate, and he does not need to replace that associate. And it's not because they're not busy. It's because his process used to be, if one of his corporate clients got filed against him, and I know I'm not going to use the right terms, but something gets filed against him, they would feed it into AI, and a brief pops out for him to read about it, and then he instructs AI on how to construct a response, and it does that, and then he reads over that, and then they send the response. Before, it was the associate would, give him a brief and tell him what was important, and then an associate would write the response. And he doesn't need anybody to do that anymore.
Well, the question is,
when that's and I told that to somebody that I met at a wedding that's getting ready to go to law school.
Well, there was
Mr. Happy.
Yeah.
All right, I got to run, guys.
All right, take care.
Let me tell you something about you. You're gonna do.
Well, there always were.
Sorry, Greg.
Greg, thank you. There always was. I don't know if you ever saw one, Russell, but the thing that always is kind of weirded me out about this AI is I think a lot of the stuff that they're doing. I mean, they're finding stuff that people have done before, and for lack of a better term, pirating it.
Yeah.
I mean. I don't know if you ever saw when there was a place, talk about a wacko story. One of my friends befriended a bunch of people up in Green Lake, Wisconsin. You ever been up there?
Yeah.
Isn't it gorgeous? Isn't that the deepest lake in Wisconsin? Yeah. Anyway, yeah. I don't know if you, but he knew there was a couple that had this small farm, and somehow or another, they became the place for anybody who essentially croaked or moved. All the books that they had, they would deliver to this place. His massive warehouse, books on top of books, which to me, I don't want to, what's going to happen to all my books when I die, because everybody's going to say, what the hell is the guy reading all this stuff? So I was in there, I was like a kid in a candy store, right? But in the summertime, they'd have high school girls show up and take some of the books out of there and actually catalog them and built a house where they were all, if you wanted a book on this, they were all organized, right? But the warehouse was not organized. So there I am out in the warehouse going through book after book, and you could sort of tell everybody, if somebody was like an economist, you'd see like 50 books on economics piled up on like this guy's stuff that he sent over. Somebody like mystery novels, you'd see. So all of a sudden I see this big book, and I'm like, what the hell is that? It was a book on business letters. And going back to God knows when, and it was a rejection letter. They're like 15... rejection letters of a guy interviewing if it was a new client.
Oh, I see.
It was essentially letters in there that were written on any subject by businesses for the last 50 years. And there was legal kind of briefs that were two pages, how to respond. And they were all, it was all sitting in front of you. It was almost like every bar used to have four books that were to settle arguments. They had every baseball stat. There was a book of, there was like five books in a row. So when you talk about the AI digging into something and coming out with a brief, I would say that any law firm like that has answered that brief 1,000 times before.
In a similar way. But he would have to have somebody write it to the specifics, and he doesn't need somebody to write it to the specifics. That one kind of blew me away a bit, but it makes sense.
Well,
makes sense. Somebody used a term that I had not that I wasn't terribly familiar with in a presentation yesterday, and I just pulled up my ChatGPT and got the highlights of what they were talking about.
Well, I tell you a perfect example of this. When I was transferred downtown from the plant at Pullman because they wanted to save me because they thought the passenger unit was going under, which it did. Well, of course, I was downtown about 3 months, and the place got taken over, and everybody downtown got fired, me included, right? Well, the treasurer was right next to me, a guy named Kelly. What a character. This dude had two assistants. One of them was Robin. He used to be on the show. and one, you know, secretary, assistant, whatever you want to call her. And the dude did more banking, I'm going to say, without AI, than any Treasury department around now, and they probably have 30 people in there. They have, because they did all this stuff with Export-Import Bank, because they're putting it, Kellogg Brown and Root used to be part of Pullman at the time. And so was Swindell, which made stacks, don't call them chimneys, all around the world. Making stacks is a massive engineering feat. If you ever see a power plant stack, it's not just putting a few bricks together when the thing's going 300 feet in the air. But they would do all this stuff. They had deals going. They had 10 banks in their approved bank thing. And it was him and like three people. But the lady, she was a riot. She told me one day she spent more time with Kelly than she did with her husband. Because he dragged her out of the typing pool when she was like 25 and he was 27. And she had been his assistant all the way through to when the guy was, but some guy had committed and give him some presentation. And Kelly was always, you know, polite to everybody. And all of a sudden the guy would go out, "Evelyn, that guy was an asshole. Tell him I never want to see him back." And she'd pipe, print out her terrific AI letter saying, "We loved having you visit. We're not going to want to use your stuff at this time." You know, that kind of crap would pipe. She must have did 30 of those a day. And now, you're right, you don't need her. You probably just hit the button and say, give me the "I don't want to see you again" letter, and it pops out. You know, I don't know that we're that much more efficient, though, necessarily. You wonder about this, Russell. I mean, I read something once about they took a guy from the Speaker of the House in 1962 or something, and he had something like 12 or 13 essentially married ladies from Washington working for him, and they did X number of bills per session without computers, every type in the crap using mimeograph machines, and how they did more bills per session than people are doing now. And now the guy has like 100 people working for him. So yeah, all this stuff is so much more efficient, but have we really gained, I guess is my question.
The only thing I think we're going to gain in is you know, maybe becoming a bit more efficient, but it ain't trillions of dollars of efficiency in my mind. Yeah, I don't think that's the whole thing. So if you take it down to a very basic corporate finance thing, if you're thinking about making a big investment in an asset, the totally opposite end of the spectrum, but the first example I use when I'm teaching this in corporate is a bowling ball machine that's going to last 5 years and generate a certain amount of revenues. The idea behind AI is the efficiency that it's going to increase. That's where you think that you're going to, you know, and it's going to create some, and maybe it did contribute to a little bit of service depression. I think maybe maybe the demand wasn't quite there as well. That might have something to do with it, but there's a lot of logic behind becoming a bit more efficient when you are providing services for people. But I just don't think the massive investment in it, you know, that's all great, but is making an investment in it, are you going to get paid back on that?
Well,
that's where I don't think that's where I start to question making a massive investment. I also don't think it's going to be a cure-all for a lot of things, and that's why I think one of the smarter ideas around AI is look at the software firms, which ones have the kind of software that is probably not going to be impacted by AI, or is a service that's too complex for you to try to do internally, and consider buying those guys.
I would agree. I just wonder. I mean,
I really liked that thought.
You get the
smart guys talking to.
If you're the group is it Amazon or who's putting together the bringing back the nuclear plant up in Michigan?
I get confused on who's doing what.
But they're
all getting involved in the power space.
Well, do you think in 10 years from now they're gonna think that was a good idea or not? Of course, I suppose you can always sell power. I mean, if the thing's up and running, it's not like you can't sell it to somebody.
All right. Well, and if they've got server farms and other things around the world already, if they, after they get their own power up and running, if they figure out it's cheaper to do things where they've got their own power, they probably will still have a use for it.
What do you think of how much of this is and we'll wind her off here. By the way, S&P futures up 5, NASDAQ futures down 2. We're not doing anything here. That's why we're not even going to some big break here. I know in the Chicago area, and I don't, you know, I'm not Mr. Electric or whatever, but I've noticed that when the CBOE was built, the current building that now they sold, one of the reasons where they justified, even though it was never going to go anywhere anyway, one of the reasons why they justified staying in Chicago, because other places said, hey, how about building it here?
Yeah.
Which would have been a big issue since everybody who worked there were from Chicago. But anyway, they didn't do that. One of the reasons why they justified it was Chicago had probably the best, I think at the time, I remember Ed Joyce telling me this, the late Ed Joyce, they had the best power rating of any city in the country by far. The CBOE building, I mean, by looking at it, you wouldn't know this, has a total feed, standalone feed from both the south side and the north side.
Yeah.
That if somebody, a nuclear bomb landed on the south side, they could totally access the north side and run the place. And over the years that I was even on the board and since then, it degraded. In the 90s, they actually put their own generator on the roof, which is like 1997 or 8, which would have been unheard of in 1983 when they built the place. And now I wonder when these data centers are coming to Chicago, to show you how crazy the power was here. When I was at Pullman, they had this massive old factory that was as leaky as you could possibly imagine. Figure the leakiest place you've ever could even imagine, and figure 10 times leaky. Well, the brilliant Indian-born engineer, Sudhir Gopinath, one of the most brilliant people I ever met, he used to be an engineer on a freighter. Well, Tom, you have to fix it yourself. You can't go to the hardware store in the middle of the ocean. The guy, I mean, that was his attitude. Anyway, he conjured up a system where they would heat the place at night using an electric heater, which makes absolutely no sense. But Chicago had so much power that the nuclear places that ran all night, they would give it away at 2 in the morning damn near. That's the reason why Finkel and Sons, a place by me that now moves south, they made specialty seal. When Jan and I were doing a show on The Score at 5 in the morning, we'd drive by there, and the doors would all be open, and you'd see this massive hearth. Not massive like you'd see at a U.S. Steel plant, but a pretty damn big hearth. It was all electric because the people only worked at night because the power was so cheap. It was cheaper to use electric than it was coal. Now, I don't think Chicago is anywhere near in that capability now to where you would even look here as a, because they took down its coal plants, right? And who knows what else.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of this, is it because we've let our power situation degrade that now it's a problem? I mean, I don't know.
That's part of it. You know, it hasn't been, the infrastructure part hasn't been kept up because there's been no incentive to keep it up.
Well, we pay huge.
You know, I mean, so I think that has something to do with it right there. I mean, we pay our bills, et cetera, but.
Yeah, it's not like Commonwealth Edison isn't driving the bills up every month, it seems.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
So what are you talking about in class? What are the questions you're getting?
Is oil going to break? That's a common one. Why are stocks continuing to go higher? You gave me the liquidity answer for that one, but that's one that tends to be coming up. I'm at a CBOS risk management conference. A lot of talk about structured outcomes and a lot of the kind of things that you've been doing forever, which I find is interesting.
Where are you? Where are you guys? The last one I went to was at the where's the place out in California where they have the golf tournament?
I know where you're talking. Yeah,
not the Riviera.
It used to be every other year.
Yeah.
California, Florida. Now it moves around. We are in Nashville.
Really? Okay.
Yes, I'm in my home state of Tennessee. Although Nashville is nothing like Memphis, that's for darn sure.
Did I tell you about the great, I think it would have been a great experience that never happened when I flew out there? I was in Vegas doing some stuff for the SIBO. I was giving some kind of lecture. And they wanted me at this thing because I was chairman of the marketing committee at the time. So I flew from Vegas out to L.A. and you had to take a limo down to wherever this place was. It started out as the original Fat Farm. Was it La Costa? Was it La Costa? Was the name of it? Wasn't it?
No.
And then, but they had a big golf course and the whole bit. Now it's there's a big tournament. Anyway, so they get me a limousine. I'm thinking, why the hell would they get me a limousine? Well, it turns out it wasn't really for me. It was for Arthur Levitt, the chairman of the SEC.
Yeah.
But of course, so and I was going to ride with him. So I get this limousine. Russell, you wouldn't believe this thing. Big, huge couches in the back, a huge bar and everything, and then there's me sitting there. Like, this is like the love boat of limousines, and I'm going, wait a minute. What am I doing in the back? I almost asked the guy, hey, can I come sit in the front seat? I feel so uncomfortable back here.
I feel kind of embarrassed about it.
Oh, God,
it.
Yeah. So guess what? We waited an hour and a half. He never showed up, so I never got a chance to ride an hour in a limousine with Arthur Levitt.
Oh, that's too bad.
I don't think he would have liked riding with me the questions I would have asked. But
you'd have driven him crazy.
You know, he was
Duke. It probably happens too, you know.
He was Duke Chapman's roommate.
Duke Chapman's
roommate.
Really?
Or something like that, yeah. You know, he was one of the guys that was when Duke gave me the me and Dr. J, he gave us the double secret sign and he goes, hey, you know why Arthur Levitt's the chairman of the SEC? And I go, John and I go, well, I don't know, he wants to do something. Evidently, if you're in a cabinet position or a cabinet level position and you come from some firm, this is back before all the idiots traded all day long, right? Back when you weren't supposed to have stock. They were given a double secret thing to sell their stock. And he was Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jarrett, which owned Pershing. He was able to sell his stock, and like, I don't think he didn't pay any taxes on it, but you got to defer them to the next year. Some story.
It's a huge tax break. And yeah. It's why all those Goldman guys go to government.
Yeah. And I think the guy from in Reagan's first term, didn't he have the guy who was the head of the chassis system was his transportation guy? Then he fired him after like 2 months or something. Remember that?
I don't. That's a little before my time.
Yeah, but not Reagan's first term. I mean, Trump's first term.
Yeah. Trump's first.
He had the guy from the chassis system was his transportation guy. Then he got rid of him after like a year. But I think he probably was able to sell all his chassis stock.
Probably.
Well, now they don't sell it. They just trade it, right?
Yeah, you don't have to sell the price. No, I think they still have to. I think they have a little bit different rules.
Yeah, but they don't.
But who knows? I don't think anybody operates in. You know, the thing is, even if there are rules, nobody follows the rules anymore because nobody wants to enforce them because rules aren't friendly.
Why you're a law-abiding dude. Why are you?
I don't know why I am.
I don't know why. You know, I really do believe we've reached the point where if you're not cheating, you're not trying, and I just can't
do
it.
I know. I just, I know. That's what I'm saying. There are days I'm like, why was I so honest? So.
There was a guy from, he used to live upstairs from a guy named Todd. I won't go his last name. I meet him, and he's got his new girlfriend, right? And he goes, here's this guy, Chief. He's a guy that if he wasn't so honest would be the richest man in town. I'm going, I don't know if that's a compliment or not, or it means I'm a dumb.
I don't know how to take that one.
I mean, are we ever going to go back? We have this argument with Carl all the time. He says, you know, this person should be taken out and shot, or this person should be hung, or whatever. If you're the first person they take out, how do you even? You have to wonder what the hell happened to you. I mean, it's like in traffic. If somebody pulls you over now, you'd say, why me? What are we doing? I mean, it's certainly in all the markets. I mean, if you're not front running, the administration, do they even know? And last week they came out and they said they don't want any staffers trading the oil market. I mean, saw that.
Well, they shouldn't be.
I know, but they didn't say any cabinet members or any family. They said staffers.
Mm-hmm.
So they left a few people out of that, didn't they?
Yeah, no, they just most definitely left some people out that should be included in something like that.
Well, what is it? Sure. So, what do you make of it? I mean, you've got to get at a conference. You've got to get questions regarding, you know, market fabric and 2% and 3% and 4% moves. And you know, you were on the show when we went. How many years without a 1% move during the day?
And yeah, that came up as well, just because you know we are talking about the volatility here. So that came up as well about how it's been very, very different.
Well,
yes.
Well, I guess my question: who makes? We used to have some people here in the building. I think they're long gone. Who makes the markets at night? I mean, I often wondered.
All the big ones. And that came up because everybody says it's just a matter of time before we get to 24/7 trading. But the Optifer guys, they hand off to they start in Asia, they hand off to Europe, they hand off to the U.S., and it keeps going around.
Well, I'm saying
that's why. It's one of four or five firms that you deal with in a market making capacity.
See, I think that's all wrong. I think that, but
yeah. No, and there are some arguments. I forgot who it was, a side conversation, but somebody was talking about how they would never have wanted to get involved in market making just because of the constant expense to keep up with everybody else.
Well,
technology wise and speed wise.
I think that the technology and speed wise is being able to see the orders coming and pull your offers or bids. I mean, it in the middle of the night when you see oil move $10 or something. I mean, somebody somewhere is making a two up market on this stuff that just the original guy gets absolutely run over.
Yeah,
and that guy becomes the buyer or the seller, so you can see how it propagates itself. Because there's no, I don't know of anybody. The only way, if we had a client at PTI that bought, where do we have oil this morning? Say it's $100 that bought, the 100 calls, for instance. I don't have a problem with that guy having a standing order to sell at like 110 that night, because if it does, he's covered with the calls and he just made out like a bandit. But if you're not backed, we trade all day long for people in the market fabric, and we're really good at it because that's what we've done. Yeah. That's why our clients are here, because they understand the difference of somebody tries to get a good price and somebody doesn't. But we've had situations where maybe we were left over on some calls for last week, and maybe we're in the spread for a credit. And they're trading for nothing, and I'll say, Dan, let's put in a 45-cent offer for these things. I mean, if we get it, we're happy. All of a sudden, you see it creeping toward 45, 38, 40, 40, 42. All of a sudden, he goes, we're filled, and the next one comes out at 60 bid, and you go, okay,
we got run over.
Well, but you can tell your client, by the way, we're in it for a credit. We sold it for 45 cents, but we got run over. And there's no doubt about that. And in the old days, if somebody was going to pay 60, if somebody was offered at 45, you would get filled at 60.
Yeah.
Now there's no kind of gentleman's thing on that whatsoever. So when you see this kind of rush happening, I think the people with the really good technology cancel all their offers, and that's why the market order is filled, $15 higher instead of where it was, because There is no customer order book like you have at the New York Stock Exchange. I know, as the people you're talking about for 24-hour trading, there's a reason for that. People around the world are up at certain times. But I also know
it's also because you can get on a prediction market on Saturday afternoon and speculate where you think the S&P is going next week.
Well, but I mean...
You
know,
so if you can do it one place, the feeling is you should be able to do it on the real, true lit exchanges as well.
Well, but I also think I know from being a trader in the OEX pit, which nobody trades anymore, but was the single best trading pit, I think, in the world. The reason why is because I think, Russell, the product averaged in the mid 60% range of customer trading with other customer.
Uh-huh.
And
I'm going to tell you something funny when we're done with this.
Yeah, because
it's going to make your head spin.
Now I bet that number is 8%. Which I think a concentrate.
Let me jump on here this is part of the CBOE's. There's a gentleman named Henry Schwartz who is just one of the best guys in our business, and he and I we do some stuff with a different podcaster sometimes, but Henry does this thing called the State of the Options Industry, and in the SPX space, It's like, and I'm gonna be off a little bit by the numbers, but the example is really the important thing here. It's like when you look at all the orders that are executed, it'd be like 60 million are for regular customers. 7 or 8 million is firm orders, which is big institutions not going through a broker, and 70 million is market makers. Things have gotten so tight and this is in the SPX complex. Things have gotten so tight that market makers are trading with market makers. Their bids and offers are crossing each other because those markets are moving around so much.
Well, I mean, if that would sort of happen. I mean, if you're
it would happen every once in a while, but
well, I mean,
when I first looked at the numbers, I was like, why, you know, I used to compute those numbers and report on them for Tab Group. You never had that. That's kind of a relatively new thing with the zero DTE options.
Well, if you're in an old trading crowd with five people in there, you never traded with another guy in the crowd.
Right. But when you got, you know, it's like 2.5 trillion in market value every day going through the SPX pit now.
Wow.
No, it's just a ridiculous. I mean, it's amazing how much it's grown since I left there 8 years ago.
Well, that's all. That's the SPX. That's the
short dated ones. Yeah,
but that's the big contract.
Yeah.
Not the SPI.
Oh.
SPY. That's the spiders. That's you're trading there. Right. But I guess what I'm saying is that if you have a 7 hour period where it's, everything is in one place. You may lose on unquote, you know, free commissions, but everybody it's much more of an auction market, and everybody's in the same place at the same time, so you gain one hell of a lot, where people aren't afraid if the market's quarter or half to put a three quarter offer in the book, for instance. You have standing markets where now you have nothing like that because I mean and some people will say, I mean, the firms do way better now. Because, I mean, the person who, if somebody comes in with a market order in the middle of the night, at the end of the day, the person taking the other side might be the person you think you're paying to be your broker, right? I mean, it's a whole different, I mean, when people talk about payment for order flow, it's not whether or not your commissions are cheap. It becomes who's the customer. If you're not paying, you're not the customer. I'm sorry. Some people are dumb enough to think they are. The person who gets the other side of your trade is now becoming the customer because they're the one who's paying the broker, not you. And I don't know how intelligent people don't get that, but or maybe they don't care. And I suppose if you're buying some Exxon for your 2-month-old child, you're not going to sell it for 30 years. I guess you don't care. But by and large, people should care. I mean, doesn't matter if you're making a one trade every 6 months, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not something that totally comes into consideration unless you're, you know, one of those guys doing a few hundred trades a day, which there are those guys out there now, too.
Well, I mean, we're doing, we don't do a few hundred, but for the size of our firm, we do a lot. And, you know, it's funny, we started the Protected Index Program. The idea of our Protected Program is you buy puts further out and sell calls near term with the intention of keeping people protected all the time. At the end of the day, making enough money on the calls to where they don't have to pay for it. Now, that's the goal. The idea was you go far out in the puts because you never had to roll them. If you rolled them two times a year, it was an unusual event. Now, we never go out more than a month on the puts.
Oh, gosh, no.
Because you're rolling them every other day, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, we would, when the war started, the market started to go down, I think we rolled our puts 4 days in a row to the downside, and all of a sudden we pop back up, and you know, it was like the cues are like 6:10, and I go, Dan, where's our puts? He goes, they're like 5.75. They go, five? How the hell are they way down there? He goes, what do you mean? It was just 5.75 2 days ago. And I go, oops, you know, I bet we should roll those things up again. We never intended that when we did this.
No, you didn't think it was an active thing you were going to be doing like that. No.
And then now that's where all the trade. I mean, we're not going to sell calls. I mean, very rarely do we sell calls because all you have to. I mean, what I just said. I mean, we're up way higher now than when the war started.
I know. There are just times that I just scratch my head and you know, it's just all about, like I said, it's just all about liquidity, and that's where the money's going right now.
Well, if I
just not a whole lot of better alternatives.
You have a greater history of the market than anybody I know, but I'll bet I surprised you this morning by about the COVID history that 2.5 months into COVID, the market was already higher.
Well, I knew that. And the only reason I was aware of that is because it was part of a presentation downstairs this week.
Okay, because I mean, I would have guessed 6 or 7 months. I wouldn't have guessed that quick. Yeah.
No, I knew it popped right back.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
it was just ridiculous.
So are you playing in they usually have a golf outing in this thing and everything? You do?
No, they don't do that anymore either. They do things that are, they have little outings at the beginning and not the end. And they were all like Nashville centric type things that I just had no interest in. So
really?
So no, I didn't do any of that.
Well, you know all about
actually, Nashville. Matt, Mike, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher his last name. They bring in really cool outside of industry speakers, and a guy named Mike Massimilio, who was a space shuttle ISS astronaut. But he also, for people that watch the show Big Bang Theory, he was on there for a little while. He's speaking about risk management and life this morning, which I'm looking forward to.
There were two we used to go to. One was the options industry and risk management. In those days,
RMC.
Yeah, in those days, the risk management was a four people jointly deal between the CBOE, the CME, which was separate at the time, the CBOT, and the London Stock Exchange. They're the people that used to sponsor it in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I remember having breakfast with the heads of all those places. It was pretty cool. Remember the guy who was the head of the Board of Trade, who's now in, is he still in jail? Tell us his name. The guy who, he was the former boxer. He was head of Board of Trade for a while. He was a character. And he ended up, he had a divorce, and then he left the country because he wouldn't pay his wife, and he came
Pat
back.
Pat Arbor.
Yeah, Pat Arbor. He came back for, he was at the table. He's a character, that guy.
He came back for a wedding, and they caught him, right?
Yeah, and he was still, and they were trying to take up a collection of all the former members of the Board of Trade to bail the guy out, and nobody liked the guy, so they anyways, he can't still be in jail, is he?
I have no idea.
But
really.
That
was a while back too.
Oh yeah, but he had been a boxer, and let's just say you could tell when he talked.
Mm-hmm.
The guy from London was pretty cool. The guy was
I'm sure.
And I'm sitting at this breakfast table with these guys. It was pretty cool. Can you imagine that? Me actually sitting there and not saying so much, listening.
No, I cannot. But in early, that's what you're supposed to do when you're young.
Yeah, I mean, it was Duke Chapman and Chuck Henry. Mm-hmm. I thought Chuck Henry was the nicest people I ever met, and one of the most brilliant. Bill Flores.
You want to hear the funny thing when you pull Pat Arbor up on like when you Google him, the first thing you get is his bio from winning from being inducted into the FIA Futures Hall of Fame in 2007.
Was that before? That was before he went to jail.
I would assume that's before they got him. Yeah.
Oh God.
So
how long are you there? Kind of are you guys done today or what?
We got three presentations this morning. Then I drive back.
Well, yeah, you drove down. Okay.
Yeah.
Now,
it's only 4 hours from Indianapolis. From Indiana.
Well, that's right. You're there.
Yeah.
Now, did you when you grew up in Memphis? Nashville's a long way from Memphis, right?
It's 200 miles.
Yeah, I mean, you don't realize how wide Tennessee is.
Almost exactly 200 miles. My grandparents were here, though, so I'd get shipped up here every once in a while in the summertime.
Well, good for you. I was hoping I'll save this little piece of paper here next week if Larissa's on. I want to go through the inflation stuff with her because I know it's close to her heart.
Near and dear to her heart.
Yep. How's she doing? Good?
She's good. She's totally good.
She's
got
a
meeting.
Well, that's good for her. I was reading about how Purdue went out and got some guys through the portal or something for their basketball team.
They already had the 10 guys that were on the team that have eligibility all chose to stay.
Not like Notre Dame where they all chose to leave.
Unbelievable.
Hey, we got a dash here, but one of my good friends and a person you know is on the board at one of the big high schools here. And he says the big thing now is not just the AI working. It's not AI. NIL working its way into the high school stuff is all the kids who think they might be getting a scholarship someday are all angling to graduate a semester early. And high schools have a real problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? It's so funny that you and I are starting to share a brain, which scares me.
Yeah.
So last night I blew off the conference thing and I went to dinner with a guy from my fraternity. There's only two or three people like that I kept up with, to this age. We hadn't seen, the last time I saw him was 2018 at Gino and Giorgetti's.
Wow.
And it's like we just picked up immediately. Well, his son is a junior in high school. And his son is about 6'8" and well over 300 pounds. And he's interviewing with a Big Ten school this morning. He's doing like a Zoom interview about what he wants to do.
Is this basketball or football?
Football.
Okay.
Football. And he was just talking to me. His kid switched high schools. He's going to a pretty high end, very expensive one here. But this guy, I think from a dad's perspective, he might be worth talking to about, what it's like, with a high school athlete now, when you know that in a year and a half, he's going to get paid.
If he already isn't.
Let's not be scummy about it. Let's just say, and that within the NIL, it's like, the private school he's going to has got a pretty nice price tag on it. And He we were sitting at dinner and he was just telling me, he goes, I had no idea it was like this. And it's because he didn't go to a private school. I actually went to a private school that's in this in the same school's conference with this Nashville school that his kid's going to. And I was well aware that, we would, I saw Lou Holtz once in the hallway at my school. We were a football school, the high school I went to, and a Catholic one. But he really, listening to it, I was just thinking, and I was just starting to text him and say, you think, because I was talking about Stocks and Jocks when he dropped me off, I said, do you think you would be willing to come on and talk about the football stuff with your son? So, and then I was going to ask you if you thought it would be a good idea.
Oh, it would be great. I by the way, I wasn't trying to be scummy. What I'm saying is...
I know what you're saying. But this
particular kid that also launched into a story about some kid who's a freshman, mm-hmm. he's been approached by school I'm near and dear with, and now a few others, but you're not, I don't think the kid's getting a check here, but they've been offered free camps for the summer.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to come to our basketball, football camp. I'll bet this kid's been offered that already. If not, he will be.
He's doing some summer camp type things this summer. I don't know. I do know that, like, Penny Hardaway, who's got enough money to pay for everybody to go to his camp, that his camp is under NCAA rules, and this may have changed with NIL, you weren't allowed to, you had to charge for the camp.
Okay, I don't know.
You had to charge, and it had to be the same for everybody.
We also were supposed to have only a couple of visits, and this kid has been told, anytime your family's anywhere around campus, kind of stop in. Right? I also told you a quick story because we got a dash. A kid from, I know his name at a high school, but he's a tight end. And he was courted by some of the big schools, but he ended up, I think he might have ended up in Miami, Ohio. I'm not positive on that. They sent a private jet up to take his mother down to tour the place.
Wow. Well, yeah.
I mean, is that counted as a visit?
And that's... I know you hear people talk about the athletes' moms and the influence they have, et cetera. I think that's true of every 18-year-old boy. You know what I mean? I think our moms have a very big influence. And if you wanted to do something major when you were 18, I don't know what kind of pushback you'd have gotten, but I'd have gotten smacked straight in a heartbeat. So I think that you hear people talk about the kid from Vanderbilt, and how a little bit of her behavior, et cetera. But I think we would have all been very tolerant of however our mom acted when we were that age.
Well, but I mean, you talked about everybody does whatever they want. Uh-huh. It used to be one, maybe two visits. Now, is the mom a visit? I'm going to say to some lawyer, the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you and I 20 years ago, if we'd have said, well, you're going to bring a kid twice, but you can bring a mom three times, we just said, what are you talking about? Now, is that okay or not? Like you say, it's a new world, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
All right, bud. Enjoy the conference. Don't get any big limousines by yourself. It's very embarrassing.
I will not do that. Nobody's sending them in limo.
Oh, I know. I should have got up with the driver. I should not have sat right there. It felt awful. Plus, I didn't know if I was supposed to take a drink or not. I didn't.
Nope.
I mean, was this really for me, or is
I just picture you going, are these free?
Oh, yeah. Is anything in this world really free? Anyway, SP Futures up 4, and SP Futures now 5. We're dead even here, pretty much. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.